Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this first regional session on the Caribbean, Creative Caribbean Approaches to HIV/AIDS. It gives me great pleasure to introduce the co-chair of this session, Dr. Carol Jacobs. Dr. Jacobs served with distinction as the chair of the board of the Global Fund between 2005 and 2007. Dr. Jacobs has been involved in HIV/AIDS for more than 20 years throughout Barbados, the Caribbean, and internationally. Indeed, between 1995 and 1998, she served as chair of the Barbados National Advisory Committee on AIDS, and she represented Barbados and the Caribbean on the board of WHO's Global Program on AIDS, and subsequently on the Program Coordinating Board of the Joint UN Program on AIDS. Dr. Jacobs, among other things, is a special advocate for HIV/AIDS for the Caribbean and throughout the world, and she is currently special envoy to the Prime Minister of Barbados on HIV/AIDS. Please welcome Dr. Jacobs to the podium.
Thank you very much, Dr. Green. I thought we had an agreement that we were going to do very short bios, but let me tell you a little bit before we begin about my co-chair, Dr. Green, who is currently the Assistant Secretary General of Human and Social Development of CARICOM, and the overhead that you're looking at is in fact the CARICOM headquarters in Guyana. He was previously the Senior Advisor for Health and Development of PAHO, and also prior to that, Pro Vice Chancellor at the University of the West Indies in Jamaica. In his earliest exposures to this program, he chaired the PANCAP's steering committee between 2004 and 2006. PANCAP is the acronym for the Pan-Caribbean Partnership Against HIV/AIDS, based in the CARICOM headquarters in Guyana. It's a very great pleasure for me to be here this morning with this very distinguished group of panelists representing a cross-section of our wonderful region. Our region is a very diverse region. We have large islands, we have small island developing states, we have mainland countries, and we have overseas dependencies. A large range of cultures and ethnicities, and we come together under the flag of PANCAP, sharing our challenges and seeking to share our lessons learned as well. One thing that we do in the Caribbean well, however, is we do know how to party. And I think that in the context of HIV and AIDS, we always have to remember that as well. Just a very quick recap of some of our challenges that we do share. I think we all share the need for capacity building, the terrific need to deal with stigma and discrimination, and to give a voice to our vulnerable groups on prevention measures, the need for us to have multi-sectoral programs, and maybe most importantly, I think, the need for looking at collecting strategic information and using it strategically to inform our policymakers as we look at legislative issues. Without any further ado, therefore, I'm going to introduce to you our first speaker. I need to say that Professor Figueroa and I go back a very long time, which doesn't make him any less distinguished. Professor Figueroa is currently the Chief of Epidemiology and AIDS in the Ministry of Health in Jamaica. He is the director of the HIV program and has been that for many, many years. And he is also the honorary professor at UWI. So there are very few people better poised to tell us about the HIV epidemic and the response in the Caribbean. Professor Figueroa.
Thank you, Carol. Good morning, all. As we know, in the Caribbean, we have the second highest prevalence after sub-Saharan Africa, 1%, with 250,000 people living with HIV, 20,000 people newly infected last year. It's primarily a heterosexual epidemic. However, men having sex with men is an important component of this epidemic and often understated. If you look at the balance between the number of men and women affected, you can see in the early days there was a big difference between the proportion of men and women, but now it is nearly equal numbers of men and women affected. The prevalence varies among the countries from just over 2% in Guyana, Haiti, Bahamas, and way down to less than 1%, 0.1% in Cuba. So there's quite a lot of diversity. What is encouraging is that several of these countries have had higher HIV prevalence in the past, and it appears to be trending down. This is reflected in the HIV prevalence surveys that are done among pregnant women in the different countries. You can see countries like the Bahamas, 2000, it was 3%. It's roughly the same. But if you look at Barbados, it has come down. Guyana, very encouraging, from 5.2% down to 1.6%. Likewise, in Haiti, you can see it trending down. Jamaica, it has been more or less stable. However, among those most at risk, HIV prevalence rates are significantly higher, and this is troubling. So although the general adult HIV prevalence is approximately 1%, you can see among female sex workers, 9.5% in Dominican Republic, 31%, 26% in Guyana, 9% in Jamaica, 21% in Suriname. These figures are very high, and we need to find ways to get these figures down. Similarly, among men who have sex with men, the first point to note is that there have not been enough surveys to define the epidemic among this group. Part of the reason for this is because of the strong stigma and the difficulty reaching these persons. But you can see that the rates of HIV infection within among men who have sex with men are unacceptably high, as much as 33% in Jamaica over 10 years and still not coming down. Suriname also. Some countries have not done any surveys. We should not lose sight also of other groups that are at risk, crack cocaine users and prisoners. Now, there are many factors driving the epidemic throughout the Caribbean. Sex tends to begin at an early age, and many of our young people have limited life skills, and sex education has not been effectively generalized in our education system. Multiple partners are common. There is a problem of gender inequity and also the gender roles, where boys and men feel that they must have multiple partners. The question of homophobia is a tremendous problem, and the stigma associated with men having sex with men drives the epidemic underground. Although condom rates have increased, they are still insufficient, and we do have a crack cocaine problem. Poverty and unemployment feeds commercial sex and transactional sex, and there's significant population movement throughout the region. So there are lots of factors related to underdevelopment, to cultural and behavioral and social norms that are driving the epidemic in the Caribbean. If we look at the reported risk behavior of persons with AIDS in Jamaica, And I think that this mirrors many of the other countries in the Caribbean. You can see that approximately 80% of persons reported with AIDS have multiple sex contacts. 25% of them have participated in commercial sex. 50% have a history of another sexually transmitted disease. IV drug use is restricted primarily to Bermuda and Puerto Rico. I'm not talking about Puerto Rico, but we do have, for instance, in Jamaica and some of the other countries, persons who are deported from abroad, especially the United States, who have used IV drugs. But it's worth noting that as many as 20% have no significant risk factor. And these are primarily women who have become infected through the behavior of their men and being sexually transmitted. These are four different population-based surveys in Jamaica showing you that approximately 50% of men report more than one sexual partner, this is heterosexual, in the past year. And this is over the last 20 years. So there has not been much success in relation to changing that sexual pattern. Transactional sex, depending on how you ask the question, only 4% of people in a population-based survey may report commercial sex. But if you ask it in a more subtle way about giving or receiving gifts or even money for sex, then you can get up to 20% or more of persons reporting transactional sex. This is a big problem in the region. Now, let me just move quickly to some of the progress in relation to the response to HIV in the Caribbean. There has been a decline in reported AIDS cases and HIV prevalence in some countries, and this is encouraging. There has certainly been a dramatic decline in HIV mortality and morbidity due to ARV treatment rollout in recent years. There's also been a significant decline in mother-to-child HIV transmission, and certain countries like Barbados and Bahamas have brought their rates of vertical transmission to below 5%. The population is generally aware of HIV and how to prevent it, and all countries have a program. However, rates remain far too high among those most at risk. Much remains to be done. This just shows you the treatment rollout. Cuba, 100%. Barbados, 80% of those persons in need. Dominica, St. Vincent, these are countries in the Eastern Caribbean. And then Jamaica, Guyana, 60%. And there are a couple countries which still need to roll out ARV treatment in a more comprehensive way. But tremendous progress has been made there. And just to show you this graph from Jamaica on AIDS reported cases in red, you can see in black that annually the number of reported deaths have declined drastically. And this is just illustrative of what the rollout in ARV treatment has achieved. We have many challenges, especially in the area of elaboration of HIV policy and legislation. There's continued strong stigma and discrimination. We need to build our national and regional capacity to deal with the problem more effectively. And I think the response in the education sector remains inadequate. Unfortunately, the approach of the international agencies often leads to fragmenting of the approach rather than to bring it in a more coordinated fashion. Now, how are we going to achieve universal access? We have a Caribbean regional strategic framework with a vision to substantially reduce the spread and impact of HIV and achieve universal access. And the priority areas, there are six of them in this framework, and one of the speakers is going to elaborate on this regional coordinated approach to addressing the HIV epidemic. This is the second framework that we're having. Countries have had anti-stigma campaigns, but it's only a limited number of our people living with HIV who are willing to come out publicly and be identified as someone living with HIV. We need a tenfold increase in prevention program coverage and resources, as well as improvement in the quality of what we're doing. HIV rapid testing and risk reduction counseling is an important component of this, but we need to build our programs to better reach those who are most at risk, as well as in the education sector, to reach all young people. Expanding HIV testing is a means of an entry point to both prevention and treatment, and far too many of our people living with HIV are unaware of their status. We have many opportunities for HIV testing. Most of us do all antenatal clinic attenders, and many persons attending public clinics with a sexually transmitted infection. But we're not adequately meeting sufficient numbers of the vulnerable populations. Contraceptive use among young people who are sexually active remains inadequate. You can see the first time a method was used among males was only 31%. The last time used among adolescent young people, you can see it was only 68% males, 52% among females. We have to do better here. And part of it is for us to accept that young people are going to be sexually active. We must not lose sight of the sexually transmitted infections. And this was a survey done in Jamaica, which shows, this was done, if you look among sex workers on the street, over 60% of them had any sexually transmitted infection. And these are the different infections that they had. If you went to the bars, the sex workers in bars and clubs, as many as 40% of them had a sexually transmitted infection. But look at the female patrons in these venues where people go to meet new sex partners. As many as 30% of them had a sexually transmitted infection, and as many as 25% of the male patrons. Sexually transmitted infections do matter. But in order to really be effective in stemming this epidemic, we've got to reduce social vulnerability. We need social programs and opportunities for the poor, including education and employment. We need to have policies that address the critical social needs and recognize the rights and affirm the rights of vulnerable populations. We need to work far more effectively to achieve gender equity and a reorientation of gender roles and expand HIV prevention to the young people and to those most at risk. There are a range of critical policy issues that we have not come to adequate grips with. Discrimination against persons living with HIV has lessened but still remains strong. And we still need to address meaningful sex education and condom access for young people. We need to decriminalize sex among men as well as among sex workers. So there are critical policy issues. In summary, HIV continues to spread in the Caribbean. Much has been done to slow the epidemic. Far more needs to be done. Achieving universal access is a realistic goal that we have set in our Caribbean regional strategic framework. Testing is an important tool towards this end. And of course, we must address the needs of the young people more meaningfully and expand as well as improve the quality of our outreach programs to those most at risk. But we must better address this social vulnerability that many of our people face and address the social norms and gender inequity that pervades our society. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Figueroa. And now it gives me pleasure to introduce Mario Klinwider. He is a specialist in mass communication, a journalist, and a social and political activist. He has worked for a variety of agencies, including the International Press Agency and the dedicated Third World and Eastern European Journalism Center. He is the co-founder of the Curaçao Environmental Movement, as well as the Human Rights Movement. And he is an advocate for men who have sex, the rights of men who have sex with men. And it gives me great pleasure to ask Mr. Kleinwuda to address you.
Mashadanki, bon dia shonang, rumanang, di Caribe e di mundo. Thank you. Good day to you, brothers and sisters of the Caribbean and of the world. It is impossible to do effective prevention in the Caribbean region if we do not decriminalize sex work. All echelons of our society provide the clients, even the politicians, but still we remain and choose to remain hypocritical and think that we can be effective in prevention in this field and still criminalize these people. My special case today is MSM. It will also not be possible to effectively do prevention work in HIV/AIDS if we do not, in the Caribbean, decriminalize men having sex with men or the practice of what other people may call sex, but I would simply call love between people of the same sex. A lot of people may not know, but a few years ago, in the Indonesian city of Yogyakarta, distinguished international lawyers, but also politicians, like for instance the former president of the Irish Republic, Mrs. Mary Robinson, came together and simply on the basis of treaties that all Caribbean countries have ratified, distills 29 principles that apply to rights of men having sex with men, but in a lot of cases are not lived up to by the governments of our region. Because when we talk about men having sex with men, we have first to answer the question, who are they? And we heard that Dr. Figueroa said that it is very difficult to approach these people. Well, that may be logical, and I'll come to the next, I'll come to the reasons why. But whereas 10% of the population, the male population of the world is considered to be gay, when we're talking about men having sex with men, we're talking about the much wider group. 10 years ago in Curaçao, a conference of men having sex with men concluded, and this was a conclusion by a group of psychologists from Curaçao, Jamaica, and Trinidad and Tobago, that at least 50% of the men in our region have had or have multiple sexual contacts with the same sex. And that from 80 to 90% of the men in our region have had at least one single contact. If we look at the principles that are in the Yogyakarta principles that I mentioned, that are based, as I said, on international treaties, then we see that it includes the right to the universal employment, enjoyment of human rights, the right to recognition before the law, the right to promote human rights. Well, in our region, human rights are curbed for men having sex with men. They are not being recognized as a valid grouping by the law, and even in a lot of countries, we are even silenced, and our right to promote our own human rights is not being denied. So why do we hide? Well, in Jamaica, friends of mine have been simply murdered because they denied, because they refused to deny that they were gay. They were shot in the head. So that is a simple right, the right to life. In other countries, like my country, for instance, where you do not get shot, your private life, when it's found out, is all over the newspapers. What about the right to privacy? A right that we have ratified as the Caribbean region. And then there is the right to security of the person. In Jamaica, those that have not been murdered may have been beaten or may have been kidnapped. And society considers that it serves them well because they do not live up to the laws of God. We'll come to that too. Men having sex with men are normal men, between brackets. They are normal because one principle of the Jakarta Declaration recognizes the right to found a family. Well, most of these men have children. And most of these men also have wives, sometimes because that's what they believe in and it's based off love, and sometimes also because they just need that facade to be safe in a society that denies them the right to love whoever they want to love. Who are they? They are white-collar men, students. They're also men who do sex work in a society where not everybody has the resources to make a living. And if you don't have any resources in a society that promotes inequity, then maybe the only resource you have is your body or your mind, and you will have to sell it. Because in our society, the right to adequate housing, the right to education, the right to work, the right to adequate standard of living, and the right to the highest attainable health standard are rights that are, again, not given to men having sex with men to the same extent as the rest of the population. So if you're white collar, you'd better live behind the facade. Now, there's a roots, of course. There are roots of the way we treat sexuality in our region. Remember that we come out of a slavery society. In the Caribbean, for a long time, for almost 200 to 300 years, the Caribbean male was a sexual commodity. He was a breeder. He was supposed to breed, and you will excuse me the wording, because that was the reality of the era, to breed with as much women as possible, to produce as much children as possible. One of the principles that nowadays we recognize in the Jakarta Declaration, the right to protection from all forms of exploitation, sale, and trafficking of human beings, that was our history. And nowadays, we do not give men having sex with men the right to equality. They are discriminated, legally discriminated by the government and by the society. They are, lots of time, object of degrading treatment or punishment, another principle. And also, they are lots of times arrested for just being what they are, so the right to freedom from arbitrary deprivation of liberty also does not count. So the effect is that traditionally we had a cover-up in our society. We considered, and this comes very clear forward in more Latin Caribbean societies, that there were three sexes. There were men, there were women, and there were maricones, bullers, marico, as they say in my country. The men were at the top of the ladder because there were two criteria for stratification. One was have as much children as possible, and second, be serviced sexually. Now, women service men in two ways. They give them children and they give them sex. Maricones, bullers, can only do it in one way, giving them sex. So that's why they traditionally were at the lower side of society. But in those societies, especially the Latin societies, there was a niche for men having sex with men, as long as they call themselves something else than men. You may see the group of those guys there, the simple situation, but lots of times the reality behind this cover-up is this. The need to be intimate with somebody of your own sex. Now, is that a crime? It is a crime according to a certain ethics that we cherish in our region, but is not based on the principle that those who can harm other people are the ones who commit crime. So there is one principle that's not in the Jakarta Declaration that we deny in our region, and it is the right to love. And that is based on the ambivalence of our religions, imported religions of both ritualistic and legalist nature. I myself am a Christian, so this is not a criticism of religion as such. And I believe that Jesus accepts me as I am. But the majority of our societies do not agree with that. Now, that is a right you may have, to believe whatever you believe. But I have the right of freedom of opinion and expression, ratified by all Caribbean countries. The right to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion, and the right to freedom of peaceful assembly and association. All these rights, again, are rights denied in most Caribbean nations to men having sex with men. What is the consequence when we talk about prevention? That the sexual ambivalence of society is being adopted by the group itself. And you want the group to do safe sex. But where? When? How? And then you're told that you're filth if you do it. So in our country, for instance, we issued a poster that said, I could go without. That would be hot. It's not about trust. It's about raw feeling. But then, would I risk life for a moment of raw passion? But what life? Remember, if you do not guarantee people the right to a decent life, they may make other decisions because then suddenly life has less value. What we need in the Caribbean is a redemption, a liberation of Caribbean culture and sexualities. We can do that, and we must do that in religion, because lots of times we focus on laws, and even there the politicians have shown very little courage in our region. But on the pulpits, we must return to the real message of the man of Nazareth. Love your fellow men. And the role models of that are there. So basically, ladies and gentlemen, what we need is for governments and politicians to show the courage that if they believe that we need an effective campaign against AIDS in our region, they will have to do away with anti-sodomy laws. But that is not enough. We need introduction of anti-discrimination laws, stigmatization, education of our populace to move away of a society that does not love its children and still wants its children to love themselves. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Klein-Mohdig. My co-chair and I have the very difficult task of having to try to keep this to time, because both of those presentations, I know you would have wanted to hear at least another 5 or 10 minutes, both from Professor Figaro and Mr. Klein-Mohdig. However, in the interest of really broadening this and having a good discussion at the end, we are going to try and manage the time and present the additional two presentations, and then we will have a facilitated discussion by Dr. Lee Kirk, who is on my right. Let me, at this juncture, thank the IAS for helping to coordinate this, in fact, for the idea of this regional session. It is, in fact, the first time that a regional session has been part of the international conference, and we in the Caribbean are very excited about this. And Dr. Green and myself are just sitting there, not able to contain ourselves at how exciting these two presentations have been. Moving right along, we have looked at the broad epidemiology. We've heard a lot about human rights and vulnerable populations. We're now going to move to the bigger picture, the regional picture, and look at regional strategic planning. The person who is going to do this presentation for you is Mr. Carl Brown, who currently serves as director of the Pan-Caribbean Partnership Against HIV and AIDS, of which we spoke earlier. Mr. Brown is a UWI and Boston University graduate, has a strong academic background in both public health and health planning, and for more than 30 years has consulted and worked extensively throughout the Caribbean, particularly in his native St. Vincent and the Grenadines, where he has been honored for this work. He came to PANCAP having served there as a permanent secretary in the Ministry of Health. It gives me very great pleasure to ask Mr. Brown to present to us on the regional strategic planning, a critical factor in coordinating multi-country responses to HIV and AIDS. Mr. Brown.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Dr. Jacobs. Colleagues, for the past 7 years, there's been an ongoing process and a very interactive process of regional strategic planning as an essential mechanism for coordinating the HIV and AIDS response in the wider Caribbean. What I'd like to share with you this morning is how that process of regional strategic planning works, and secondly, what have been some of the lessons that we have learned from this process. The Pan-Caribbean Partnership Against HIV and AIDS, in fact, reaches out to 29 countries in the Caribbean, stretching from the Bahamas, Cuba, all the way down to Suriname and Guyana in the south. And this process of regional coordination had its genesis in the Pan-Caribbean Partnership Against HIV and AIDS that was established by the heads of government in 2001. And when the heads of government established PANCAP in 2001, it gave it a three-pronged mandate. First of all, to coordinate the regional response to HIV and AIDS. Secondly, to lead the process in developing regional policies and promoting regional programs with a benefit towards regional public goods, and also to mobilize resources for these efforts. The fulcrum around which all of this works is really the Caribbean Regional Strategic Framework, which is a strategic plan for the Caribbean that all of our partners buy into. This strategic plan, the current version of it, has six priority areas. Priority area number one deals with policy issues, legal issues, and how do we move along in those areas. Secondly, the area of intersectoral response. How do we ensure that HIV and AIDS cuts across all of the sectors for the benefit that we want? And of course, prevention as a fundamental aspect, treatment, care, support. And then we deal with the issue of capacity development as we move forward in this process. And then finally, the whole important area of monitoring, evaluation, and research. Those are the six priority areas around which all of the partners of PANCAP collaborate and coordinate. But let me say that there has to be a very clear link between the regional strategic plan, the regional efforts, and the national efforts, so that the Caribbean Regional Strategic Framework links very closely with the national strategic plans of countries. And what we have is an interactive process. The Regional Strategic Framework, the emphasis is on regional public goods. National strategic plans, of course, the emphasis on national public goods. Essentially and fundamentally, PANCAP is all about partnerships. Partnerships that ensure and work around a shared vision among all of our partners, collaborative action, and mutual benefits. Those are the elemental principles of this partnership that we speak about. And I just have on the screen here the partners we have, the categories of partners we have, our national authorities or regional institutions, civil society organizations, networks of people living with HIV and AIDS, our bilateral, multilateral partners, our development partners, all of whom come under the umbrella of PANCAP and work together in this partnership. Two quick examples of partnership. During Cricket World Cup 2007, this is a clip of how UNAIDS and UNICEF and the Caribbean Broadcast Media Partnership and PANCAP came together to promote some of the promotional things for ICC Cricket World Cup. And very recently, in June, as we had World AIDS Testing Day and Caribbean AIDS Testing Day, this shows how the private sector in Scotiabank in eight countries came together with ministries of health, with the Caribbean Broadcast Media Partnership, with PANCAP in putting off this HIV regional testing day, an example of the partnerships that we have. But what have been some of the major achievements of this whole process? We think that today we have greater commitment from governments across the region to HIV and AIDS and to the process than we have ever had. There is very broad-based involvement in this process. PANCAP now has more than 70 partners in various categories. We have increased coordination among our, not just the countries, but the regional institutions, civil society. There are very key areas in which we have delivered public goods and public policies. We can talk about those for the rest of the day. There's been enhanced resource mobilization, both within countries at the regional level and international level around PANCAP. And we pride ourselves in improved sharing of information, which is key among our partners. And to crown all of that, I just say to you that in 2005, when UNAIDS looked at the work that we are doing within PANCAP, UNAIDS thought it was an international best practice. And in fact, the PANCAP experience has been recorded in the UNAIDS International Best Practice Series. But we have had our challenges, of course. When PANCAP started, we started from scratch. There was no institution like it anywhere in the world. There was no formula. There was no chart to go by, and we had to build the structures. And that, of course, took time and took effort, and we learned along the way. Linking national and regional plans and national and regional efforts is in itself a challenge. How do we delineate roles when you have 70 partners? That takes some negotiation and some skills there. There have always been resource limitations in the Caribbean. These limitations are both technical and financial. We had to overcome those. There's the issue of expectations. Often we have found that expectations outweigh the resources that we have, and we have to balance that. And of course, in the Caribbean, there's always been, continues to be a problem of monitoring and evaluation. How do we develop our surveillance data? But importantly, what are the lessons that we have learned from this whole process? We have learned, one, that political leadership and political ownership is essential. PANCAP has been blessed to have had prime ministers in an era, Prime Minister Douglas of St. Kitts and Nevis, Prime Minister Arthur of Barbados, to name two, who have been really behind this process. We have had support at the ministerial level. Minister Slater from St. Vincent and Grenadines, to name one, comes to mind. But very strong political leadership and ownership is important. And don't forget that PANCAP was established by a decree from the heads of government of the Caribbean. Secondly, there has to be a strategic plan, a strategic framework. There has to be a point of reference around which our partners will collaborate. And that's a very important lesson. It is also important that the work we do is grounded in good evidence and good empirical data. And for that, we need good economic and social analysis. That is very important. Any organization like PANCAP that has so many members, the structure as we have it has to be clearly defined, roles have to be defined, and that's an important lesson so that we avoid issues of overlap and things like that. The role of the PLWHA community is important. They're an essential part of this whole process. And I would say finally that the support from our developmental partners, both technical support, financial support, advocacy support, is a critical lesson that we have learned in this whole process. And so I just close this presentation, ladies and gentlemen, by giving you a clip from the last annual general meeting of PANCAP that was held in 2007 in Antigua, and you see representatives of our partnership there. One happy PANCAP family. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Carl Brown, for providing us with the notions of how we can use a regional network to strengthen the impact and the accelerated approach to HIV/AIDS. And now it gives me great pleasure to introduce Cloyd Pien, who is the medical director of HIV/AIDS in Haiti and coordinator of FAMI Perio Institute. She introduced the innovation of HIV/AIDS services to local communities in Haiti. And last year, the Haitian Medical Association awarded Dr. Payne to be a pioneer, as being a pioneer in the HIV/AIDS fight in Haiti. She will speak to us on lessons learned in the rollout of the infection rate in the urban areas of Haiti, and in particular on the role of community-based strategies. It is my pleasure to ask Dr. Payne to come to the podium.
Thank you, Dr. Green, Madam the President, Co-Chair. First of all, I would like to thank the PenCap committee for your invitation to allow us to share our Haitian experience with you. Ladies and gentlemen, in urban areas in Haiti, the HIV prevalence was relatively high in key population and in the general population, including pregnant women. For example, the HIV prevalence among the sex workers was as high as 60% in the late 80s and dropped to 20% by 2003. Among the blood donors, the HIV rate reached a peak of 7% and dropped to less than 2% in 2004. Among the pregnant women, this rate was around 6% in 1993 and fall down to 3% in 2003. So, consequently, at the beginning of the 90s, the incidence of HIV started to decline in Haiti. A team of Haitian experts tried to match the incidence with some events to try to understand the reason for declining of HIV. So what they found that the dynamic of the epidemic, the transfer from the disease to death, the big effort that have been made at the for the safety, blood security, have played a big role. And other major factors also have acted in synergy. For example, the big role of the national aid, the national program of control of AIDS, the good partnership of public-private people, the big mobilization of resources, the opening of new services, and also the big important scientific work made by the GESCO group and the Zami La Santé group in Haiti and other research groups. Now, in 2006, the national level, the national seroprevalence rate is 2.2% with 2.3% in the urban areas and 2% in the rural areas. Although HIV prevalence at the national level is relatively low, 2% as we just presented, FAMEPEYO Institute, which is located in a low-income, high-risk area in Port-au-Prince, had registered HIV prevalence as high as 10%. We have reviewed the data of the past 2 years. On this graph, we can see the clients that we tested every month, and from January, you can see that these numbers of clients tested per month has been increased. And what we found a seroprevalence rate of more than 10%. Here on this graph, we have the enrollment per month, and as you see, we have these enrollment patients and the the active patients, and we reach a level of 95% of adherence rate. Although the numbers presented here at the clinic are not representative of the national level, however, the key lessons are, instead of waiting for the population to come to us, by going to the community, we have been able to raise the reinforce our counseling, to raise the level of adherence, and to raise also the number of people who wanted to be tested. And this has been done because we put in place some mobile teams that go to the community, they go to churches, households, they go to public markets, schools, etc. And I have to notice also that we have a very good visibility on the ground because most of our health workers are living in those areas. But in this, I will not go through all the cultural practices and factors that all my colleagues have already, but I want to emphasize on the fact that even if we had, since years and decades, many information campaigns, I must say that up to now, the youth particularly, they know, they have the knowledge, but as we saw since Monday in this conference, they don't behave, they don't have the behavior. So, considering the cultural practices and the importance that Fame Pereo put on outreaching to the community to anticipate problems, the challenge is how to change sexual behavioral practices in high-risk, high-density population characterized by low income and low level of public health services. We do need now to focus our efforts on prevention. We have developed a prevention and reduction model. The goal of the model is to change the sexual behavioral patterns in the community to reduce those practices that contribute to the HIV/AIDS infection rate. There is very little information available on the cultural, economic, social factors that affect the sexual behavioral practices in the community, and most importantly, the drivers that could be used in sexual change strategies. A multidisciplinary team would conduct surveys in the community to better understand the sexual behavioral practices and their drivers and utilize these to develop cultural appropriate and location and age-specific sexual change strategies. The team will assist the community in intensive efforts to implement the change strategies by empowering the community through the training and deployment of behavioral health counselors. A community mobilization program that involves the community-based organizations and providing incentive for rewarding appropriate sexual behavioral practices through a promotion campaign. These community-based interventions will be targeted on keeping the uninfected healthy, thereby reducing the rate of infection and the high cost of treatment for the infected. The model also provided for the testing and treatment of the infected through the clinic-based program for counseling, testing, and treatment as described before and promoting family planning strategies. An anti-stigmatization program and community-based activities to promote productive lifestyle for the PL-HIV. A continuous process of data collection and monitoring will be operating to evaluate the effectiveness of the change strategies and their implementation methods. This allows for a continuous process of refining that will improve the efficiency of the model in achieving its goal. The sustainability of the model will be addressed through developing mechanisms to finance the community-based activities through community-led efforts. Resources for the clinic-based activities will have to be provided through a partnership with the government and donors. In looking to the future, Fame Perio Institute has a strategic approach focused on improving its clinic-based services and outreaching these services to the urban communities that it serves. Introducing preventive strategies that focus on mobilizing the community to reduce and eliminate risky sexual behavior practices. A critical focus in this effort will be the role of the youth as agents of change, and in particular, targeting vulnerable girls who are often difficult to reach because of social and cultural practices. These prevention strategies would reduce the number of the infected and therefore the highest cost of treatment and have enormous economic and social benefits. The investment of these strategies will be very low and affordable on a sustainable basis for those low-income communities. The returns of this investment will be extremely significant in economic and social terms, but even more beneficial for human and community development. Consequently, Fame Perio Institute is urgently seeking partners to implement the project in one of its low-income communities of 350,000 people in its neighborhood to implement, test, refine, validate the model, which could then be the basis of development and implementing community-based prevention strategies on a national basis. In conclusion, in the Caribbean today, where treatment strategies for the HIV positive are rapidly expanding, the way forward is to focus on prevention, on keeping the healthy and uninfected. The priority for designing and implementing prevention strategies needs to be substantially increased. Let us also recognize that reducing the infection rate through prevention substantially reduces the cost of this disease to our health sectors that have limited resources. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Pierre, for dealing with the case study on community approaches. In about 2 minutes I have, just to see if we can bring the various presentations together, you would agree that we had 4 very stimulating presentations. And it's important for us to note that from the very beginning, Professor Figaro did indicate to us that there have been successes, but also in the balance sheet, it's a mixed scorecard. It's very important for us to understand from his presentation and echoed by the others that there are underlying social and cultural norms that act sometimes as barriers to the accelerated approach and which must be overcome. And I think from the presentations, it is very clear that among the barriers include strategies and policies that place greater emphasis on sex education, that help to reduce stigma and discrimination, really, that together drive the epidemic on the ground, and in particular to address the issue of homophobia, to which both Professor Figaro and the speaker Mario Clenmuda referred to. Now, it seems to me that from the discussions, several very important lessons have been learned and several proposals that might help in the discussion that you have. First of all, the aim to achieve universal access to prevention, care, and treatment is itself a lofty one, but without which we could not win the fight. And that is one of the lessons. Secondly, it's very important for us to really promote testing and to ensure that testing becomes more widespread as an important, as a strategy. Then there was the case which was put forward of dealing with the issue of MSN as a human right, a very novel but not new presentation that we heard, largely because it is argued that human rights relate to the right to love, the right to privacy, the right to security. And in fact, ending with a challenge that this perhaps lies at the foundations of what was called as liberation. But I think when we went to the two presentations at the end, Mr. Brown's and Dr. Pien, what emerged really were some of the very important attributes of partnerships and of institutional organization in order to ensure that there is a collective approach and a scientifically grounded approach, which really increases public awareness through a variety of partnerships, public, private, and in particular, emphasis being placed on partnerships with vulnerable groups and taking into consideration those priorities. It seems to me, ladies and gentlemen, that in the discussion period, there are so many aspects here that, in fact, it might be difficult to contain this session within the boundaries of the time allotted. But I'm sure that we will have a very fruitful discussion. But before we have that discussion, my co-chair will just make an intervention.
Thank you, Dr. Green. Now, it's just coming to your time for this meeting. And to facilitate this session is Dr. Alison Leacock of Barbados on my right. I look at Dr. Leacock's CV, and I'm saying this lady has got to be 80 years old to have had all this training in all these areas. But as many of you may not know Dr. Leacock well, let me just give you some of the broad areas of her training. She has degrees in educational technology. She's a trained professional with diplomas in the areas of human resource management, facility management, arts management, and the one I hope she will not need to use today, alternate dispute resolution. She has a well-rounded career in Barbados, working in both the private and public sector, and has been CEO both of the National Cultural Foundation, which coordinates all the cultural events and cultural programs, as well as being general manager, not at the same time, of the Caribbean Broadcasting Corporation, which is the government-owned radio and television station. Dr. Leacock currently is working with the Kaiser Family Foundation and has established the CBMP regional headquarters in Barbados. She served as the chair of the steering committee of the CBMP since its inception in May 2006, and I also do want to share with you that among her many attributes and productions, she produced the ICC CWC 2007 World Cup closing ceremony held in Barbados last year. Dr. Leacock, you are clearly well qualified to facilitate this discussion session, and we look forward to this entire session. Thank you.
Dr. Jacobs took advantage of the prerogative of the chair not to adhere to the brevity of introductions, but nonetheless, thank you, Dr. Jacobs. And I think those of you here would want to join me in thanking the panel for capturing the diversity of issues confronting the region. So, as Dr. Jacobs says, this is now your time, and I have the task of navigating it, basically. A few ground rules so that we can maximize the productivity of our time and your contributions, as well as the benefit of the panel's responses. We welcome comments, questions, suggestions, but we ask you, in so doing, that you A, use the microphone so we can hear you. Two, identify yourself and the country from which you hail. Make your questions, comments succinct. I know that can be difficult. Think through what you want to ask before you do. If you need to write it out for brevity and clarity, please do, so that we can, in fact, get the widest participation from all of you here. We'll take about three or four questions together so that we can then have the panel respond. If you have a specific question for an individual member of the panel, please indicate that, and we'll ensure that that individual responds directly to you. There have been a number of critical questions raised. I think ultimately HIV is the great revealer, and it is like a mirror to our cultural identities, and we have to start looking very closely at what we see. So the floor is open to any questions or comments. I'm sure there's somebody with a microphone running around to get it to someone here. Please proceed and identify yourself.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. The name is Leroy Trotman, Bristol, Barbados. I would wish to speak to the matter of challenges, and before doing so, compliment those who have spoken from the podium. Much of what has been said, Madam Chair, relates, in my view, to the world of work. And I think you would accept and agree that even where the trade union movement is not involved at the leadership level, that the education which has to be done is either going to be done through the trade union, assisting others, of course, or by having nurses and teachers particularly help in the process. In fact, we also are going to be very important in reducing stigma and eradication, since workers are going to want to relate more to people with whom they give their confidence and who help them in other matters of their other rights. And consequently, I am of the view that building confidence to treat the testing will better be done by the labor movement. What the trade unions are offering, and I'll be very brief, is the challenge to others to allow us to be more greatly involved in partnership involvement. And I say not only trade unions, but NGOs which are able to bring their capacity to assist. At the global level, we are now searching for a better regulatory framework to address the rights-based approach. And that is particularly important given the comments made by our Curacao presenter. What we are searching for, and we wish comment on, is how the panel will be able to assist in this exercise in that rights-based approach, which we are trying to present through an instrument in the International Labour Organization. Next year, we are hoping to have an ILO instrument. We wanted to have a convention. We have to make do, unfortunately, with a recommendation. And we would like to have your support in lobbying governments, in lobbying employers, and where workers and the church may not want to participate, in lobbying them as well. And we would wish to have your comment regarding the extent to which you are willing to support our effort to have that regulatory instrument next year and to make sure that the proper codes are put in place and are adhered to by all members within the Caribbean.
Thank you, Sir Roy. I think we will take two more questions and then let the panel respond.
Glenys Alonso Beaton, Guyana. My first question is, YWCA, young women, I haven't heard in the discussion investment in women and young girls being a strategy, and HIV now has the face of a woman or a young girl. What are we doing as the Caribbean for investment in women and young girls? Second question, Mario, as a human being, I totally respect everybody. But my morals come into play when I have to make a choice with what that individual do. How do you see the Caribbean, which came from an upbringing of MSM, was never in our culture, as being accepted. I have no problem with them, but how do you see us now helping you to change what you've presented in your people?
Thank you. We have another third question, and then we'll take one more and go over to the panel.
Maria Dillon Remy from Trinidad and Tobago. A question for the PANCAP representative. As we are looking at scale-up of antiretroviral treatment, and we are talking about Caribbean partnerships, is there any consideration for looking at treatment options across countries? Most countries now are offering ARV free of charge for their nationals. Is there any consideration for the Caribbean for persons, particularly persons migrating for work? Is the Caribbean going to consider that the nationals of the Caribbean are going to be treated in each other's country with ARVs free of charge?
Thank you. We'll pause there and let the panel respond to those three issues, the one from labor, the one about investing in our women, and the third question. Well, there was a second part to the question from the YWCA on the issue of the Caribbean responding to Mario, and then a specific question to PANCAP on the scale-up and looking at treatment.
Okay. This is a challenge. I'm answering the question of the sister from Guyana. This is a challenge for the Caribbean, but it's a very interesting challenge because I've brought the similarity to the front lots of times. The Caribbean will have to deal with accepting and giving due rights to the MSM minority in the same way as the white people of the southern United States have and are still dealing with that, accepted the rights of the black Americans among them. I would like to just one remark also to the first speaker. Yes, I think that in general, the trade union movements of the Caribbean can play an important role. And I will advise my Caribbean network of MSM called Cari Flags to also undertake an initiative of entering into negotiation with both the trade union movements in the respective countries and regional institutions, because trade unions are a rights-based organization, and it will be very interesting to see to what extent they will also embrace the rights of the MSM. Thank you.
Thank you, Mario.
Okay, I just wanted to respond. Do I have a mic? Yeah.
Carl Brown's mic.
Okay, thanks. The first question that relates to the role of the trade union movement, I just wanted to say that 2 years ago, within the framework of PANCAP, we established what we call the Caribbean Tripartite Council on HIV and AIDS. That is really an amalgam of the labor movement. In fact, it is chaired by the Caribbean Congress of Labor. It includes the private sector, and it includes governments. And as part of that process, we have been moving to develop, along with ILO, regional workplace policies for the Caribbean. In fact, we have developed a model workplace policy for the Caribbean that we are currently rolling out in many enterprises across the region. I would say that, again, priority area number one of the new Caribbean Regional Strategic Framework speaks to promoting policies and legislation. And I can say categorically that we'll be willing to work along with the trade union movement and anyone else to push along any legislation in this regard. We can talk a little bit more in the corridors on that, Silly Roy. With respect to treatment options, I just wanted us to be clear on the role of PANCAP. Go back to the slide where I say there are certain things that have to be done regionally and certain things that have to be done nationally. PANCAP as a regional entity is responsible for providing regional public goods. So that, for example, one of the major things that we have done in the last 5 years is to lobby very vigorously with the drug companies for the reduction of the cost of antiretrovirals. And those of you who know would know that the cost of antiretrovirals have come down for first-line treatment at any rate from $10,000 in 2004 to perhaps less than $2,000 at the present time. It is my understanding as well that most of the countries that provide ARVs, it is done free of cost. As far as I'm aware, there is no country in the Caribbean that is attaching a cost to treatment with ARVs. In fact, some countries have an oversupply of funds and ARVs. In the wider framework, though, when we talk about PANCAP, I think there are two initiatives that we need to speak to. One is the initiative that is being done jointly between CARICOM, PANCAP, and this Caribbean Development Bank for a regional health insurance system that allows a measure of portability that would certainly support people moving from country to country with treatment. And of course, there's an important move ahead as well to develop a Caribbean Public Health Association, all of which is going to help in this process. And I just leave it there. Thank you.
And I don't think the panel has responded to the question about investment in our women and young girls. Which of you is brave enough to take that one?
Thank you. When we were talking of investing in the youth, of course, it's girls and boys as the behavioral health counselors at the community levels.
Thank you. All right, back to the floor now. And I see many hands, so let's try to take a cluster
over here
and respond.
I'd like to follow up on the point that Dr. Payne just attempted to answer. I'm Andrew Francis from Jamaica. I actually missed most of the presentation, but I caught the small part that she made on the fact that programs are not particularly changing sexual behavior among young people. I think it's not by chance, but it's by choice. It's a choice we make, one, because young people continue to be absent from the design of policies and programs that impact them. That, in fact, is very, very present here today. I think for the fact that more than 50% of the youth of the population in the Caribbean are young persons under age 24, and with the very high rates among young people in particular, it would have been very critical and very, very commendable if a young person was on the panel this morning to speak to the issues that affect this population. I believe that we will continue to choose and choose badly in terms of how we design programs for young people if they're not placed at the center of our response to the epidemic within the region. And that's something we have to contend as moving forward, that young people must be brought to be a part of all these regional initiatives, all these national initiatives that place them at the center, so especially the marginalized and vulnerable groups of young people can be dealt with. Thank you.
Good point. Next question.
Good morning, Trinidad.
Good afternoon. A pleasant good afternoon, my beautiful Caribbean people. Troy Banner from Belize. I would like to commend Mr. Mara for a wonderful presentation. And I must say that the MSM population was here before we were born, is here, we are living with it, and we are going to die, and it's still going to be here. Secondly, people living with HIV and MSM population are vulnerable groups, and we need to address these groups. Most naturally, the MSM population. Regardless of whatever lifestyle you live, if you don't accept it, I'm sorry for you, because we are here. Again, I don't care if it was not in your life or you didn't grow up with it. You never know, because you see this face, it might look different from what you perceive it may be. Thank you.
Thank you, too. I think there was a young lady over here from Trinidad and Tobago, and then over here.
Good afternoon. It's Adrian Martin, Trinidad Express newspaper. Last Friday, the ministers of education and health from the Caribbean
signed a commitment with respect to comprehensive sex education in schools, including HIV education. But we've had commitments before. CARICOM has a commitment for health and family life education that has remained unfulfilled for a couple decades. I want to ask Mr. Brown, what role can or will PANCAP play in terms of ensuring that those commitments are seen through so that we do have a syllabus for comprehensive sex education in our primary and secondary schools? And part two, what are you doing about the MSM issue?
Thank you. Over here.
Thank you very much, Gottfried Henschel. I'm with the Pan American Health Organization based in Washington, previously in the Caribbean. I would really like to congratulate PANCAP and specifically, obviously, Carl Brown and Peter Figueroa for the development of the Caribbean framework. I think it's a great framework for partnership action. I'm also glad to see that there's one strategic priority in there which speaks to legal action and legal frameworks. And I would like to link that to the presentation of Mr. Klein-Mördich and really like to see to what extent you think within the next phase of this framework you will be able to address the very difficult issue of decriminalization of both sex work and homosexuality in the region. I would like to say from the PAHO perspective, we will lend every support to this conversation, to this very difficult dialogue that you will have to make, and to really show that from a public health perspective, these laws that still exist do very much impede access of those most vulnerable groups. Thank you.
Thank you. We have time for about two more in this round.
Okay. My name is Murillo Williams. I'm from Suriname. Here I am.
Okay.
I'm from Suriname, and I'm here with the Mexican Youth Force. At first, I would like to thank the panel for the presentations. And as it was stated in the last presentation, youth are the agents of change. I totally agree with that. I was just wondering, it was presented by the representative of PANCAP, a number of priority areas and a number of partnerships. I was wondering, how are young people being involved? And I don't mean being involved as in investing in young people, as it was said by the woman of Guyana. I mean really involving young people in optimal decision making within the program of PANCAP. Thank you.
Yes. I think it is on.
Hello, everyone. It seems there are not too many Asians here. I'm Frank Orgina, when I'm in drag. I'm from China. I'm the founder of a CBL called TransChina, Alliance of Chinese Transgenders, and I'm also one of the 10 board members of the International Gay and Lesbian Association Asian branch. I'd like to raise up the issue for transgender people. It sounds to me that just now the panelists were just talking about MSM issues, but it seemed to me, and it's strongly with me, that at least transsexuals are not MSM. So I'd like to really draw your attention and share some information regarding transgender communities in Asia and around the world. So firstly, I'd like to get a small response. Is transgender included in your MSM initiative? That's something I'm really disappointed, and I'd really encourage you, all of you, to attach great importance to this issue, because based on the evidence in Asia and around the globe, if we neglect or ignore the existence and the great importance of this community, then it would be disastrous, because as you know, most transgender people or travesti in your own culture, 80 or 90% of them are sex workers. So it's kind of a triple stigma, discrimination, and marginalization. Thank you.
Thank
and
you
also, I'd also like to call on call upon any transgender or transgender-friendly friends here to really work on trans issues. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We've had about 5 questions in that round, and I'll hand over to the panel because, as always, time is slipping away. The focus of engaging the youth from inception in policy and programming, the issue of MSM populations and vulnerable groups in general, the issue that was raised by our colleague from Trinidad on the CARICOM commitment with regard to what role will PANCAP play in instituting the syllabus of sex education in our primary and secondary schools, and the issue of legal action. So there have been quite a few issues thrown out there. We have only 7 minutes left, so I'm going to ask the panel to also respond as quickly as we can so we can have a final round of maybe 2 questions.
Yes, with respect to youth involvement, I think everyone on the panel would appreciate more youth involvement. Many of the programs in the Caribbean do make an attempt to reach out to youth, have youth coordinators, and work among the youth. I know that in some programs, some of the community outreach workers are actually young people. And I know at the level of PANCAP, they're actually youth ambassadors who usually attend the PANCAP meetings. But there's no question that we need to involve the youth more actively. And especially in the education system, I would like to see that, but at all levels. I don't know if Carl would like to add anything more from the PANCAP point of view.
Well, just to say, Peter, that I agree that youth need to be more involved. And from the point of view of PANCAP, on the executive board of PANCAP, there's a seat for a representative of youth, demonstrating a commitment to having youth being involved in the policy-making, the decision-making, and hopefully in the rollout. While I have the microphone, a couple of comments. I hope we're not seeing PANCAP as being equivalent to CARICOM, because they're different. CARICOM is a member of PANCAP, and the executive board of PANCAP has 20 different members drawn from various categories that decide on policy. So that, in fact, when we talk about PANCAP, we talk about the broad partnership. Okay? Now, the certainly from where we sit at PANCAP and within CARICOM, we would seek to ensure that we lobby governments that they follow through with this commitment. But if you know, there's a regional commitment that has to find application at the national level. So we then move from the national level to the regional. And from where we sit, we are committed to providing the kinds of advocacy that we need. I have not, in fact, seen that declaration coming out of the meeting last week yet. I've heard snippets of it. But certainly that is something that we'll follow through on. I just want to say as well that for the last 3 years, and there are many persons in this room who have been in that process with us, we've been trying to promote to develop policies around law, ethics, human rights. And we're at the point now where we have an agreed set of policies around human rights that we will take to our parliamentary councils and hope that they will begin the process of formulating legislation around that. It's a process that has been going on for the last 3-4 years, and as I said, there are many persons in this room who are part and parcel of that process. And we hope that, I think one of the questions was, how far do we get in the next 5 years? I hope that we can make very significant progress on that. In fact, coming out of UNGAS, it was one of the issues that was flagged for attention.
And Mario, I think you wanted to make a comment.
Yes, so reacting to my brother from China, when you saw me indicating no, it was because I was actually honoring what you said, that trans persons are not MSM. There is a regional network for sexual minorities that I mentioned called CARIFLAX, which is the Caribbean Forum for Liberation and Acceptance of Genders and Sexualities, which include genders, was especially included to focus on the fact that transgenderedness is something else than sexual preference, because in transgender community you have different sexual preferences. We won't go into that. So yes, they are, and we see that as a separate
group that should organize itself, but they are also the weakest group where organization is concerned. That's why I think the focus is on MSM. Answering my sister from Trinidad, education is important, yes. And I have an example in Curaçao. 10 years ago, when the gay movement started in Curaçao, I suppose because it was something new, we were approached by the education department to write the chapter on homosexuality, bisexuality in the new curriculum for secondary schools. Now, I would suggest to the Caribbean governments to do the same, because basically, giving the authority to write, to explain who we are, what is important, what are the rights that's important for us, what actually is MSM, and to give that opportunity to the group would give us the opportunity to really, really talk to the society at large and do the right education without falling into arguments about ethics. It would also be very good thing, I think I'm referring to what the gentleman of PAHO said, that I think that the way forward with the very, very stern position that certain governments, like the government of Jamaica, have on not wanting to abolish the anti-sodomy law, one of the reasons that this is accepted by the societies is that there is not a focus on human rights. People think out of religious ethics. They have a right to do so. But when we talk about these topics, these are not religious topics. They are topics that are about human rights. So what we need all over the region is a widened concept of what human rights education should be about. And if international agencies would want to help with that, they would be very welcome. In general, I think one of the solutions that we should work on is for international agencies to support regional organizations of sexual minorities, because the fact will simply be that a lot of these governments will, not for the foreseeable future, take the steps needed. So then you need to empower those nations, because we are a nation. I, my brothers from Suriname, from Belize, from other countries are a nation. These groups in our society to organize themselves at the regional level, so that at least we are empowered to put pressure on our governments. And finally, my brother from Belize, he said it right, and also referring to what my sister from Guyana said. We are part of the culture of the Caribbean. Minorities are part of the culture. In my country, I'm constantly confronted with the sentence, no da parte di nos cultura. It's not part of our culture. Minorities are part, and it is a typical thing of our culture that we do not accept that. So yes, majority may have its ethics, but our group also has its ethics, our history, and we are here from the first moment, from before the time the Europeans came. And that when societies in the Caribbean accept that fact, and not only this minority, but also other minorities, then we can really, really be an inclusive society that can move forward to a better Caribbean.
Thank you very much, Mario. We have run out of time, unfortunately, but I hope that you can continue the dialogue with our panel informally at the end of this. Claude, I believe you had one final point to make.
I am asking if Dr. Moise is in the room. He is one of our very well-known physicians. He has a very good experience in the involvement of the youth in Haiti. Dr. Moise, you are in the room? Yes. Can you say a few words, please, from your experience with the youth?
Madam Chair, with respect, Madam Chair,
Where are you? I'm sorry, right here.
With respect to the, I am Minister Slater from St. Vincent, and I think it might be useful, as probably, I don't know if there are any other politicians in here, I think it might be useful for me to make a comment.
Certainly.
Okay, yes. Well, certainly let me congratulate the panel on their presentation. I just want to say, though, that who are politicians? We are citizens, and as I understand it, we reflect the opinions of the society. We live and we believe in a democracy, and generally we reflect a democracy of the majority. However, we should also respect the minority views. we are a society in the Caribbean of a religious background, primarily Christian background. We have issues of, we have moral issues that we are confronted with. We have legal issues, and we have public health issues. And besides being a politician, I am a public health practitioner also. There are very many serious challenges, and we should not expect, I don't think it is reasonable to expect that by the snap of the finger, we will have some of the changes that we want or we expect. I think quite often, quite frankly, too often, a lot of blame is placed on the politicians. We must remember that, as I said before, we reflect generally the sentiments of our community. And politicians are not in the business of suicide. They don't want to make decisions that might be suicidal to them. However, we must as leaders listen and understand the needs of minorities. And we try and continue to do that. But I think it is important we acknowledge the challenges in respect to the declaration made just last week. Yes, and many countries have made efforts in sexual education in schools. I can speak for my country, and I know for many other Caribbean countries. It isn't that we have not done anything. We need to do more, but please understand that these changes, like all changes in history, take some time. One of the things about human beings is that we are inherently resistant to change, but when it is necessary, we must find a way, and we hope that we should work together, all of us, to find a way to make these changes that are necessary. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Minister. And, of course, the issue of leadership will continue to be paramount in making the difference and making the changes. We did have a colleague invited from Haiti to make a contribution on the involvement of youth in Haiti. Could you please make your contribution now, sir? Thank you.
Hello, Alison.
We have 10 minutes more. We've been granted 10 minutes more. So we will allow some more contributions.
Haiti.
It's only 5 now. It's been cut. So our colleague from Haiti, please.
Okay, sorry. Thank you, Claude. Thank you to invite me to talk about very briefly, and I say 1 second, and just to say that in Haiti youth, in fact, in partnership with the government, all NGOs and involved in the fight against HIV and AIDS, we are putting young people as much as we can in all of our activities. And in fact, I can say that in the youth program, talking about voluntary testing, counseling, and youth program for people living with HIV and AIDS, we do have youth peers who intervene very actively as counselors and also as main actors in the fight against HIV and AIDS. But I believe that we do have a lot of to do, talking about the integration of youth in many other activities and also at school level in the program of Ministry of Education. Those are the things that I believe that in the region we can address together and see how PANCAP can play a key role as a regional strategy, how we can address the youth integration and youth active participation in the fight against HIV and AIDS. That's it.
Thank you very much. So, ladies and gentlemen, you've been a great audience, lots to talk about. I just want to leave you with a couple of questions and hand over to the chair. And the question that Mario raised is important, I think. Why do we hide? And we are expecting someone else and some other entity to make the difference. I think it has to start with you, individual action and empowerment. And I leave you with our slogan, which is live up. Love, protect, respect.
Leacock, thank you very much, members of the panel. I think you have truly reflected the diversity of our region. You have given us much to think about and to discuss. As usual with these discussions, we run out of time. But let us continue. Let us move it past the discussion to action. I would, and my co-chair, Eddie, would like to flag in particular the involvement of youth and the vulnerable populations and how we can mainstream this. let us not forget the wonderful suggestion made by one of our panelists, Mr. Klonenberg, about actually getting this into our curricula in the schools in the region. I think this is a huge gap in our education, and I really would like us to take that home and see where we can go with it. Thank you so much, everyone, and thank you, Dr. Leacock, too. Thank you.